Ross Sowell tried very hard not to swear as the Carisian schooner swept towards him. Obviously, his information was even more out of date than he'd feared when Bishop Executor Thomas gave him his orders. He hadn't expected to see Carisian warships actually inside Erastor Bay proper. Then again, he hadn't expected to see the gold kraken on the back of the Carisian flag flying above what used to be the Emeraldian fortress on Callie's Island either. The dispersal of the Carisian warships was the clearest possible evidence of the totality of their victory at the Battle of Darkos Sound. The true extent of the Allied fleet's defeat had still been unclear when Sowell left Manshir. That it had been crushing was obvious, but everyone in Coruscant had clung to the hope that the majority of the ships which had not returned had found refuge in Emerald, where they were even then helping Narmon defend their anchorage. Obviously not, Sowell thought sourly. He could see exactly four ships now, counting the schooner charging down on his own command, and every one of them flew Carisian colors. They were spread out widely as well, to cover as much of the bay as they could, and they wouldn't have been doing that if there'd been any possibility at all that someone might consider attacking them. That, coupled with the fact that all the island fortifications Sowell could see from his quarterdeck had clearly become Carisian bases, not Emeraldian ones, made it abundantly clear that there was no Allied fleet any longer, much less one that was still defending its anchorage. Sowell had never before encountered one of the Carisian's new schooners, and he was astonished at how close to the wind the thing could sail, and by the size and power of its sail plan. His ship had the same number of masts, but the Carisian had to have at least twice the sail area. It also had the stability and size to carry more sail, and it was driving far harder under these conditions than his own ship could manage. The number of gun ports arranged along its side was at least equally impressive, and he felt his stomach muscles tighten as the stubby muzzles of cannon poked out of them. Father? He glanced at his own second in command. The one-word question made the other priest's tension abundantly clear, and Sowell couldn't blame him, not that he had an answer for what he knew the man was actually asking. "We'll have to see what we see, Brother Timothy," he said instead. "Hold your course." "He's not changing course," Irvin said. As redundant statements of the obvious went, that one took some beating, Hewitt thought. "No, he isn't," the commander agreed, with massive restraint as the range fell steadily. It was down to less than 300 yards and still dropping, and he wondered how far the other skipper was going to go in calling what he undoubtedly hoped was Wave's bluff. "Pass the word to the gunner to stand ready to fire a shot across his bow." Irvin hesitated. It was a tiny thing. Someone else might not have noticed it at all, but Irvin had been Hewitt's first lieutenant for over 6 months. For a moment, Hewitt thought he would have to repeat the order, but then Irvin turned heavily away and raised his leather speaking trumpet. "Stand ready to fire across his bow, Master Charles!" he shouted, and Wave's gunner waved back in acknowledgement.